Christianity for the past 1,000 years has cared more about the death of Jesus than his life. It wasn't always so. Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Parker in their book Saving Paradise make the case that for the first several hundred years of Christianity, the focus was quite different. And as they studied Christian art, they discovered that the images of Jesus in the very first centuries of the church were of a shepherd, a healer, an infant, a teacher, an enthroned king, but he's never depicted as dead. If there's a cross in the image, Jesus appears in front of it in a resurrection scene. The artwork is vibrant with heaven imagined as a transformed earth. So it wasn't for 1,000 years or so that the dominant image of Jesus was one of torture and death on a cross. The cross surely existed in early Christianity, but it wasn't until much later that the art and the resulting theology depicted Jesus as a bloody corpse on an instrument of torture. Christianity has had a strange relationship with the cross and with the death of Jesus. As artwork and theology transformed it into an obsession over the death of Jesus as saving people from their sins and their guilt so that they could buy a ticket to heaven above, Christianity became the theological justification for imperial conquest. The ritual of communion that many find increasingly distasteful, focused on symbolically or somehow literally in a magical way, ingesting his flesh and blood. With grim faces, the congregants come forward like something out of The Walking Dead to consume their weekly dose of Corpus Christi. Lost was the celebratory feast of an open table with lots of real food, symbolizing the bounty of earth and the joyful participation of everyone led by the dispossessed toward the beloved community. The great feast type of communion is making its way back, however. I try to focus on that, but it's a tough change because the death of Jesus is so embedded in our practice and in our liturgy that even when we use other words, the mood and obsession with guilt, I'm so bad that Jesus had to die for my sins, lingers. So communion is one of the areas in our ritual practice, I believe, that's in need of reformation. In addition to reforming the rituals such as communion and baptism into the death of Jesus, we also have the task of reforming the theology that accompanies it. And so this series of sermons is on churchy words, how they lost their meaning and power, and how they can be reformed, restored, revisited, and if none of the above, then rejected. And today's words are death of Jesus. How did Jesus die and why? That's the first question. How did Jesus die and why? And the next one is, how does the answer to the how and why encourage us in the present to participate in the flourishing of earth and of humanity? I don't think that the death of Jesus needs to be the centerpiece of Christian thought. It's there, and it needs some reflection, but it doesn't need the central place. When we think of Martin Luther King, we don't make the centerpiece of our study about him or our use of his work in the present, his assassination in Memphis. We recognize it as part of his story, but his legacy is not his death. We focus on what he did in life. Other figures in history get similar treatment. Abraham Lincoln, Joan of Arc, for example. Even as their deaths were violent, it was because of what they did in life that their deaths have a noteworthiness about them. But their deaths themselves are not the focus. When Mel Gibson's movie came out about 12 years or so, anyone remember seeing that, The Passion of Christ? The advertisement for it had an image of Christ's head bloodied by a crown of thorns, and the caption read, "Dying was his reason for living." And that phrase sums up most of Christian theology for the past 1,000 years, including the dominant fundamentalist theologies in both Catholicism and Protestantism. Many of us are challenging that mythology. Dying was not his reason for living any more than dying is your reason for living, or my reason for living. Yeah, we're all going to die. It's healthy to confront our mortality so we can live with awareness and with mindfulness. Your life and mine will end one day. So don't let your legacy be in the words of that Dr. Hook song from the 70s, "I got stoned and I missed it." A healthy recognition of our mortality can motivate us to live a bit more courageously and mindfully in the present. But must our deaths define who we are? Must fantasies of the denial of death define us either? And for most of Christian history, the answer has been yes. Death and the fantasies about it. But there is a way to approach life, in the words of theologian Paul Tillich, with the courage to be. For those who've confronted the abyss, whether that abyss be grief or disappointment, the smallness of humanity and the vastness of the universe, or the brutality of the powerful, there is yet the possibility to face it squarely and to say, nonetheless, I choose to be. So this movement to see Jesus as a resource for life is coming of age. This movement focuses on his parables with an understanding of his context in first century Palestine under Roman imperial rule. His parables invite us into an open-ended conversation about what it means to be human. And when I say what it means, I don't mean that something outside of us gives us meaning, but we're invited to create our meaning, not only as individuals, but as a human community and society in relationship with all creatures of earth. And I would hasten to add that as we reflect on and practice this process of meaning-making, we will discover that we're not simply engaging in first-world amusements. Because of Jesus' particular history, we cannot in good conscience see our lives as disconnected from the suffering of creation caused by, in a major part, imperialistic theologies and practices of the first world. So we do come around to the death of Jesus. The question of how and why will be important. It's important in particular for wisdom on how we might live in this present and how we might imagine, as Jesus did in his time, a way of being that is life-giving instead of death-dealing. So the how of the death of Jesus is pretty straightforward, even as it's not understood in its political context very often. But Jesus was crucified. Because this word's been co-opted by various theologies, a more evocative word is needed. Jesus was executed, pure and simple. He was executed by established authority. James Cone of Union Theological Seminary, in the passage that Larry read, says a word that's even more evocative, and that is Jesus was lynched. In this case, the authority, while not established, was indeed recognized and even celebrated by the powers that be. The historical fact is clear. Rome executed thousands by crucifixion, and it did so in order to keep the peace. The instruments of imperial death and torture were in public spaces as a spectacle of Rome's authority and power. This is what happens to those who step out of order. Call it state-sanctioned terrorism. And that's what lynching was in the American South. Between 3,000 and 5,000 African Americans were lynched between the end of the Civil War up into the early part of the 20th century, between 3,000 and 5,000. These lynchings were often public spectacles of white dominance to keep African Americans in a status of subservience and in a constant state of fear. Lynchings were terrorism on behalf of the white power structure. Remember what it was like to take a picture in 1920? It wasn't simple, right? It took a lot of work to get your focus. So who's taking these pictures on that bulletin cover? It wasn't just somebody picking up their iPhone. It took some work to stage a photo like that. And there were many photos. They would be made into postcards sent to friends. Bring the kids. It was a part of what it was to engage in this kind of dominance. And it was done in large part by those who on Sunday morning would call themselves Christian. If we today want to understand the crucifixion of Jesus, we might contemplate not images of Jesus on the cross or a beautifully embossed, gold-plated or brass-plated cross or jewelry that you can buy in the Christian bookstore, but instead contemplate an image such as on the cover of today's bulletin, a person lynched, a black body hanging, surrounded by an approving and gloating mob of white people who may even pretend they're doing it in God's will. Those are the facts of history. lynchings in the United States of America and executions by crucifixion in first century Palestine that Rome had claimed as its own. So what does Jesus have to do with it? Well, Jesus was one of those caught and crushed by Rome's wheel of oppression. He might have done nothing to deserve it any more than any one of the other thousands did anything to deserve it, any more than any one of the thousands of African Americans did anything to deserve what happened in our recent past and what still happens today at the hands of state-sanctioned police. Jesus was chattel. He was in the way. He was an example. So the why question from the perspective of history is because Jesus was used to reinforce the spectacle of brutality and imperial conquest, to keep people in line. It's what people around the globe see when they observe the spectacle of American imperialism. For instance, just today, the people of Yemen, who are being bombed by American-made weapons and with the assistance of American jet fuel and American intelligence on behalf of the brutal dictatorship of Saudi Arabia. What are the people of Yemen to America? In the way, a product of a geopolitical deal. In the scope of things, I suppose it really doesn't matter much. You'll not even likely hear about it with the noise of Trump's sexual bravado dominating the airwaves. I think the situation in Yemen is illustrative of Palestine in the first century. Rome barely gave Palestine a second glance until they acted up and needed to be crushed. Why did Jesus die? Simply put, he was in the way. So when we ask, though, why did Jesus die, we aren't really asking about history. We're seeking a cosmic, metaphysical meaning for the death of this particular individual. And that's how we came up with all the various theologies of atonement and dying for sins and what have you that begin with the writing of the New Testament itself. But we need to know that that second-order reflection on the historical reality of imperial brutality that was given the name Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome. It's world domination with a pretty name. It is brutality around the globe today, sprayed with the perfume named freedom and democracy. That's what the United States is giving Yemen, freedom and democracy. The U.S. Navy in its television commercials calls itself a global force for good. That depends upon a point of view. So what might we say to the cosmic, metaphysical, Christian faith question, why did Jesus die? What does that mean for us who bear a connection to Jesus and to the Christian tradition? Well, the meaning for me is that Jesus, from Rome's perspective, was nameless, like the thousands of others, like the thousands lynched, like the thousands murdered and tortured as the price of empire's control. Yet from another angle, every one of those murdered and lynched human beings had and have names. And Jesus is the name that stands for the nameless. It actually has a meaning. The meaning is God saves. The meaning is that the nameless matter. Not only do they matter, they lead. If we are to forge a beloved community, we follow the lead of the nameless. The nameless from empire's perspective, but named from, if you will, God's perspective. Mark Lewis Taylor, my professor at Princeton Seminary, calls this event the executed God. The cosmic meaning, the meaning of a life of conscience, is to recognize that divinity is in solidarity with the nameless and the oppressed, with the murdered and the lynched. And the nameless has a name. The nameless has the courage to be. That's why, for example, naming is so important in the Black Lives Matter movement. The sacred ritual of saying the names to bring dignity, to bring divine consciousness, is what can sustain a movement of resistance. Jonathan Farrell, John Crawford, Azel Ford, Laquan McDonald, Akai Gurley, Tamir Rice, Eric Harris, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Samuel DuBose, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile. Name the names. So the question isn't why did Jesus die as much as why do we remember his particular story? And we remember it theologically, today, gathering in a community, we remember it to bring awareness of those the power tries to keep nameless. We recall the story of Jesus not as nameless chattel, but as an invitation and a summons to stand with those who are bulldozed by imperial power. I find myself amazed and amused when people think that the church shouldn't be political. It is political to its core. You can't help but be political. The question is, whose politics will you follow? Christianity's founder was executed by established authority to reinforce the politics of Pax Romana. You can't get more political than that. So when the Pax Romana co-opted the story of Jesus, did a wonderful trick. It attempted to strip it of its message of resistance and thus had it serve empire with theologies of guilt and control and afterlife for those who were obedient. Now we need to reclaim and reform this inheritance for the flourishing of humanity and for earth. I hope you'll take up the challenge with me. Amen.